The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, we will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
Dan Oliver reading The Day the World Broke by Autumn Owens. We're eating our last meal tonight, a grim last supper, except there is no savior at the table. Everyone is quiet, even Emma, but for once I wish she'd talk. Aunt Nellie pops a bottle of champagne in the backyard as all the adults look on, clapping weakly. Aunt Nellie laughs, her hands covered in alcoholic froth, but it's a manic sort of laugh, tapering to a high pitch and ending abruptly. She pours the champagne into thin glasses, and then she falls quiet, too. We slide into our seats on the back patio. Dinner is a hodgepodge smorgasbord of everything we loved. We'll never eat it again, so we pile our plates liberally, clean out all the bowls, and lick our forks clean. We go for seconds. Emma eats so much that she vomits in the garden, all over Mom's carefully tended carrots. Nobody bothers to hose it away. Time is precious. The breeze is playful at first, lifting our hair and tangling it. It grows stronger as supper marches on, blowing leaves off trees, tipping water glasses, eventually knocking a bowl of hot tomato soup into Nanny's lap. We ignore the wind and the purpose behind it, tittering lightly and passing around napkins to sop up our spilled food. After the food is eaten, the kids move into a circle in the grass to play games. Down by the banks, concentration, childhood favorites, those games that older siblings pass down to the little ones. My cousin Sandra suggests we sing something, so we craft an off-key chorus of Down by the Bay, all of us singing half-heartedly. The song dims out, and the circle breaks up awkwardly, kids silently slipping back to their parents. The wind becomes so strong that we are forced to go inside. Dad and Uncle Mike board up the windows. Mom locks all the doors. We all file down the stairs into the basement, where steel warehouse shelves stocked with cans of green beans and carrots await us. The time has come to talk. We can put it off no longer. We huddle in small groups, whispering to each other about the events to come. The little kids, Mary, Lucas, Amelia, don't understand what's going on. Aunt Nellie hands them a bag full of suckers and gumdrops, and they consume their candy in the shadows of our new prison. I am sitting with Sandra and her brother Peter. "Quick," Sandra says, "tell all the things you want to be known, your secrets and your ambitions." Peter and I glance at each other. "Go on," Sandra urges. "We don't have much time left." She glances at the window well, which fills with all the debris the wind carries. Leaves, mostly, a lot of leaves and twigs, but also teaspoons and socks and mangled metals. Peter says, "I'll play." When I was 12, my teacher took our class apple picking, and I tipped Annie's ladder and she broke her arm. I blamed it on Kevin, and everyone believed me. Sandra bobs her head. "Good, good," she murmurs, more to herself than to Peter. "All right, Caden." Sandra looks at me. "Go." "I don't have any secrets," I say. In the window well, I can see the carcass of a dead kitten. Probably belongs to the neighbors. They just had a batch of new kittens last week. Last week, when it was springtime and beautiful and flowers were blooming. "Please," Sandra says. "But I don't have anything to tell." A raging gust of wind blows against the house, and above me, I hear the place where I grew up crack and collapse. I close my eyes and start to cry. Sandra curls her arm around me. "It's okay," she whispers. "I did it," I confess, tears dripping down my face. "That's my secret. I did it."
"You did what?"
"This whole thing, the destruction of the world. I think I caused it."
"No, you didn't."
Sandra rubs her hand up and down my arm. Peter looks up at the window well, which is now pooling with water. The rain has started. It won't be long now.
You wanted to hear my secret.
It's okay. I shouldn't have asked.
But I think I caused it.
You didn't. You didn't. I'm doubled over, sobbing fiercely. Sandra hugs me tighter. A hand touches my back. My mother. She's joined by my father, Aunt Nellie, Mary, Lucas, Amelia. Everyone crowds around, some crying, all leaning on each other, everyone holding someone else's hand. Beneath us, the earth begins to break.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and this is Time of Reflection by Doug Lane. There's a dead man in the mirror staring at me. I don't know how I know he's dead. Maybe the cold cast of his eyes, how his obsidian pupils and irises of dark fog gaze through me from behind. Maybe it's the lack of animation, the razor line of his mouth, the sluggish movements that lead him nowhere. He's no one to me, too old to be my late father. Wrong face for any of my friends, their dads, my instructors. He resembles no one famous or infamous. He's not even an echo of a dream. Trying to catch his gaze, I wonder how he came to be in my mirror. Mom thinks it's stress. He first appeared around the time I began prep courses for the Stellar Service Placement exams. When Dad died, university went with him. The service guarantees money for deep space work, deposits with commas, the right coin to lift Ma and my sister from the poverty block to a sky suite. Off-world is a dragon country, like Maps used to say. But the dead man isn't my stress. He's as real as I am. Is his presence behind me a random error? A soul astray in the afterlife? Did he live in this fire trap before us? Or is he here with purpose? If so, he's made no overt attempt to communicate. He's a sullen expression, that stare, his maddening silence. I've been unable to search the net for his face. I can't capture his reflection on Digicam. He wears an illegible name badge. I managed a sketch of his jumpsuit logo. It's a real outfit, Apogee Hydro. They mine elements on Callisto and in Saturn's rings. I emailed their human resources director about recent worker deaths. I never heard back, but the logo offered chill enough. Apogee recruits hard from the services ranks. Is the dead man me? Cut down in an indeterminate future and returned, warning against a bad choice? An untimely fate? A death so restless it's made me both apparition and premonition? I try to see myself in him and fail. I can't imagine my eyes so cold and dead.
I'm Warren Keyes, and I'll be reading Conduct the Stars into Silence, written by Lynette Majaya. First movement. You are 8 years old and lying outside at night, staring up at the stars. There is no light pollution because you are far from any city and because the electric company shut off the power 3 days ago. Inside the rusted travel trailer, the heat was suffocating, so Mama dragged the mattress from her bed out here onto the thick green carpet of grass. Even with the mosquitoes and without much in the way of breezes, this is much better. Through the moist summer air, the stars shimmer as if they are dancing to the tune Mama hums quietly. You aren't sure of its name. Probably some old gospel song she learned as a child, or snatches of a country and western tune she caught on the radio. You can't help but notice that the music is slightly off-key at times, but her voice is the center of the universe, and so this matters not at all. She folds you into the crook of her arm, and together you watch the stars waltz and sway. Over the summer, you will spend many nights on that mattress, watching the stars turn to the soundtrack of Mama's lullaby. It is your last good memory of her before the cancer comes. Second movement. You are 15 years old and lost, adrift on the tides of foster care and indifference. Your teachers marvel at the ease with which you compute limits and calculate logarithms, the numbers sifting through your fingers like grains of sand. You skip class, smoke weed at the park, and perform a variety of petty vandalisms out of sheer boredom. Aimless destruction is your only guiding principle. At night, you walk the streets, eyes focused on little more than survival. Above you, the stars dance, unnoticed. You do not sing. You do not remember how. Third movement. You are 25 years old and a graduate student, subsisting on noodles and coffee. Snatched from the jaws of oblivion by a physics teacher with a penchant for lost causes, you spend your days teaching undergraduates how to ride the waves of the sine and the cosine, your nights buried in the depths of chaos theory and quantum mechanics. There is no time for songs or the memories of songs. The stars have become theoretical, tiny pinpoints that exhibit no practicable purpose. They do not emit enough light to read by, and therefore go unnoticed. Fourth movement. You are 27 years old and pregnant. The physics teacher told you that he loved you, and you believed it for a little while. There is no job protection for adjunct faculty, no matter how brilliant. You teach until you can't anymore, and then you couch surf until the baby comes. The women's shelter is a last resort, but it's better than nothing. You take a job teaching high school math at an adult education center. You search for something better on a computer at the library. Your daughter looks up at you with your mother's eyes, and so you rock her and hum a bit, just snatches of melody from a half-remembered childhood. Your feet ache, and you dream of escape. Your eyes inevitably wander upward. Fifth movement. You are 38 years old when the asteroid is spotted. 18 months out, and the only hope for survival lies within the secrets of probability. You laugh at the chaotic nature of the universe, but you close your eyes and send a prayer up anyhow. While you await on the results of the lottery, you watch the news with increasing panic. The asteroid looms, becoming visible in the night sky. You lie, blatantly and outright, and tell your daughter that everything will be fine. Sixth movement. You are 39 years old when the news comes that your daughter has won a seat on the ship that will escape this world. Your heart feels as if it will melt with relief. She cries, and you comfort her, promising that it will be an adventure. You help her pack the few things she is allowed to bring. That night, you drag your mattress outside into the thick summer grass. You hold her in your arms, run your fingers through her soft hair. Suddenly, from the depths of memory, you hear it. You thought you'd forgotten the words ages ago, but one look up at the stars, and it's all there, as if the music had been recorded, as if their light had held the words like a promise. You begin to sing.
I am Dennis Corcoran, and I'll be reading The Slide by Forrest Brazeal. Noah Carmody, age 4 years, 7 months, and 2 days, dove headfirst into the top of a covered playground slide, the one in the indoor play area at Burger Jack, and never came out the other end. His mother, Mrs. Carmody, became annoyed when Noah did not respond to repeated orders to come out and eat his chicken nuggets. Her irritation changed first to astonishment, then gradually to panic, when she wriggled into the slide herself and discovered that it was empty. Mrs. Carmody crawled through every inch of the play area. She threw the balls out of the play pit, scooping frantically with both hands. Noah had disappeared. Law enforcement arrived on the scene in due course. Police detectives reviewed Burger Jack's security tapes. Nobody other than Mrs. Carmody had entered or exited the play area since Noah climbed into the slide. Mrs. Carmody insisted, growing hysterical, that someone must have been lying in wait for Noah inside the covered tube. But 24 hours of security footage, all the store had, revealed no such person opening the play area's single glass door. Not even Mrs. Carmody had seen anyone leave. The police tested swabs taken from the play area, turning up a rather disgustingly large variety of DNA, but nothing that could be matched to a known criminal. Local news caught wind of the story, and Mrs. Carmody's tearful interviews soon went viral on social media. Conspiracy theorists and anti-government truthers produced bizarre explanations for Noah's disappearance. They got an unexpected boost from a distinguished professor of physics at Caltech, Dr. Russell Morton. Morton, who nourished a fascination with multiverses and quantum entanglement, was the first to suggest that Noah had entered the playground slide in one dimension, ours, and slid through a transient space-time rift into a parallel universe. The covered slide itself, he excitedly told CNN, had the exact physical characteristics of the interdimensional wormhole he had sketched out in his latest journal article. Martin's claims generated substantial public interest, making him a minor celebrity. He purchased, at his own expense, a covered slide identical to the one that had swallowed Noah, which he unveiled at a press conference while Mrs. Carmody bit her knuckles on the dais beside him. Martin then sent crash test dummies through the tube with infrared cameras around their necks. The dummies emerged in a normal way at the mouth of the slide, with their legs and arms tangled and nothing of particular interest on their cameras. Both they and Martin looked quite foolish, though this did not prevent him from publishing a popular book about his ideas called The Carmody Files. Eventually, prevailing opinion turned against Mrs. Carmody herself, the only adult known to have entered and exited the play area after Noah had climbed into the slide. Careful review of the security footage showed that she left the play area, crying and calling for a manager, her coat momentarily bulged as if concealing something. Mrs. Carmody said the bulge was a trick of the camera angle, and anyway, it wasn't her fault that she'd had trouble losing Noah's baby weight. The police pointed out that she had run into the parking lot before finding a manager, out of sight of the security cameras, for which she could provide no explanation other than simple distress. Anyway, Noah's body never turned up, and without any physical evidence, the case against Mrs. Carmody never really got off the ground. The most notable outcome of the whole affair was a temporary drop-off in attendance at public playgrounds in general, and Burger Jack in particular. Matthias Jack Berg, the chain's founder, made a rare late-night TV appearance in an effort to restore public trust. "We may never know exactly what happened to little Noah Carmody," he said, "but we are stepping up security measures to ensure that customers of all ages feel safe and welcome in our stores. It's the same reason we make every meal from fresh, sustainably sourced ingredients." And he smiled for the camera. And he bit into a juicy, tender little Burger Jack slider.
Hi, this is Susie Pratt. I'm reading The Beauty You Cannot Buy by Marie Vibert. Carl had the delicacy of a hothouse flower. I knew from one glance he'd end up breaking my heart, but we all love to repeat our favorite mistakes. He recrossed his elegant, silk-clad legs. "I want beauty," he said. "I want to inhabit beauty, to feel it." I gestured and the wall displays changed. Pictures of past clients were replaced by medical cutaways. Clean bones and perfect muscles exploded outward into diagrams. It wasn't just informative. It elegantly turned away the squeamish. Working against my own commission, perhaps, but I wanted him to change his mind. I drew up our most traumatizing surgical diagrams. There's no reason to go beyond surface treatment, surgery, cybernetics. It's reasonably priced and completely safe. All our custom bodies are achievable this way. Dragon wings, prehensile tails, feathers. "Cellular level," he said. "I want to be perfect on a cellular level." Ah, Carl. I knew I'd have to give in. He wanted it so extravagantly. "Yes, we also have the full retrovirus reprogramming. It's intensive. Your body will reject existing tissues and limbs as new ones grow." I called up worse images. "There'll be weeks of follow-up surgeries." "Yes," he said, leaning forward, mouth open. "Destroy me and remake me." I wished I could take him back to my place and enjoy that body he wanted to discard. I let my leg linger against his. He didn't react. I leaned closer. "I'd love to see what I'm destroying." He brushed me aside. I was blocking part of the display. No one is as self-involved as those who want to conspicuously consume themselves. Especially my type, the quixotic ones. I pulled up the consent forms. "Let's get you started." Most who said they wanted to be beautiful went straight for the fairy options. Longer limbs, insect wings, enlarged eyes. We also did a fair amount of work in angels and dragons. We had ridiculously masculine and ridiculously feminine bodies. We had plain ridiculous. Carl wanted none of that. He made me page through our entire catalog and show him how to drag the images around to compare them. "Different. Unique," he said. He held a feathered arm to a wolf's chest. I don't even know if this will work," I said. "The retrovirus has to be consistent, Carl. Let's look at the successful alumni again." "No, I'll tell you when I find my perfect match." Those intense, tawny eyes. "You should be easy to match," I said, and let my finger graze his angular jaw. "A perfect match for anyone." But he only wanted to examine skin colors and talk about variegation genes. "Ultimately, there has to be an element of randomness if you want multicolor," I said. He chewed his lip for a long time. "That's acceptable," he said. "One decision, at last." I breathed a discreet sigh of relief. He couldn't decide between feathers and scales. He couldn't decide between variegated browns and variegated greens. He couldn't decide between longer or shorter limbs. It took 3 increasingly frustrating appointments for Carl to make his choices. He would be a transitional beast, bird, reptile, elf. Parrot feathers in jewel tones, a fan of a tail, and scales that dotted the skin like sequins, dents here and there, creating darker jewel tones, and the skin underneath a random brew of indigo and mango. Large eyes, of course, with scale feather brows and high, swept pointed ears. I had to admit, he would be lovely. The engineers were excited, too. It would take nearly our entire catalog of gene splices. His expression as he signed waiver after waiver was intense joy. I felt heavy, sending the orders across, closing all the open catalogs. My wall screens returned to holding patterns with a sense of finality, like the closing of wings. Your first injection is tomorrow. Carl sighed. He looked at me, just me, and we were finally in the same place. "Now," he said, "I feel beautiful." "Before the treatment?" He made a dismissive gesture. "That will make me exotic. Today I have the beauty money can't buy. I'm fleeting, ephemeral." I put my hand on his. "I could burn my eyes on you." And was that surprise on his face? Had I somehow come off as subtle? He kissed me then, and my mouth opened against his like a scream. I feared his skin would break apart like spring ice under me, but his answering caresses were steady, calm. He lay back and let me enjoy him, exultant in this body he was sacrificing. He believed he had the glamour of a cut flower. Why do I fall hard for idiots? I tore at his hair and pressed him hard to feel the bones inside. I used my passion to show him he was beautiful from the moment we met, before that. He was born temporary. Heartache? Now that can last.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.